verses together. In case you're blind, somebody has a birthday today, but I'm too old to have figured it out, you know. This morning, my wife presented me with these two balloons, one of which is nice enough just to say happy birthday. The other one says, "You're how old?" And she says, "You're lucky. I saw one with a Grim Reaper on it." And the Grim Reaper said, "Don't worry, I'm just here for cake." You know, so that's the kind of stuff I'm getting all morning. My staff presented me with a new necktie. It has fish on it. They thought that was appropriate for agriculture and natural resources. Considering the amount of time we spent, they said that they tried to get one with shellfish on it in honor of a couple bills that we've had some fun with. Anyway, I expect to be abused all day, especially since Senator Corcoran has just arrived.
We're going to have another one of these lengthy, pointless hearings today. Is that the reason for this? Yeah. Okay, good.
No, it's a birthday party.
Oh.
You didn't understand that? You didn't get the invitation?
At bowling last night with the governor, birthday party with you today. Life couldn't be better.
You can hardly stand it. I can tell he's in a good mood. Just remember that his sense of humor was left in the airport in where, Phoenix?
County Cork, Ireland, 1942.
Oh, I think we'll stop there and adjourn. No, we weren't. The first thing we're doing this morning is, as I said the other day, we have both bills kind of open simultaneously, and I had on my schedule the other day when we canceled them, Senator George was first, and so I'm asking Senator George, he'll come up and he'll be followed by Senator Ringo, and they'll be each presenting their bills. This is a public hearing. I thought I had said it was a public hearing. Did I not do that? I don't know if I... It's a public hearing. Okay, it's a public hearing. Thank you for helping me out there.
Happy birthday to you.
Yeah, right.
Right. You don't want me to sing it? For
no,
the record,
no.
I'm State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. Part of the Tillamook burn area was basically on the edge of my district. And back in 1990, when I was campaigning for the first time, it included the bulk of the Tillamook burn. We did Senate Bill 699 on behalf of one of our volunteers who has worked in my office, Don Fell. Don can't be here right now. He's down in Southern California. And I talked to him earlier this morning. He sends his regrets that he can't be here, but one of his children is involved in a major athletic tournament, and he needed to be there. Now, what I'd like to do, we're going to be in a few minutes looking at a videotape called The Sea of Green, produced by the Department of Forestry, and I'd like to give you a little background. If you go back with me to one of the early immigrants into the Oregon Territory, one of those people was, in fact, Nathan Coote Sitton, and it's a long-lost relative of mine. And an interesting thing was a story that came down through the family was the fact that they were invited by the Native Americans in about 1847-1848 to go to spend the winter with them, not in the Willamette Valley, which was filled with brush, but in fact to spend it in what is now would be known as the Van Duzer Quarter. Now you would ask, why would anyone spend the winter in the Van Duzer Quarter, which is very cold and very wet? And the reason was, at that time, it was not a sea of green in the sense of trees, but a sea of grass. And the reason that that was the case is either from lightning or because of the fact that the Native Americans would set fire to the Coast Range at about the Nestuck, it would burn south, that there was actually very, very few trees in that area. So some of the third harvest that we've seen through the Van Duzer Quarter area and a lot of privately owned forests have in fact been a result of three sets of harvests since the middle 1800s. What I would like to talk to you today, though, is about a major concern that I have had going back to hearings that we had in 1999 when I was chairing this committee. And the hearings were on the issue of the forest health. And one of the things that bothered me a lot was to find out how much of our forest was infected with Swiss needle cast and the level of destruction that was occurring to that forest. One of the problems that we find with the Tillamook is when the Tillamook was reforested, we didn't know about tree zoning. And if we could turn down the lights and run the video, you'll be able to see some of the reasons that we have a beautiful forest, but also the reason we have a beautiful forest with health problems. If we could do that at this time, I'd appreciate it. It's about 5 minutes. It's a portion of that sea of green tape.
Just as far as you could see, it was just snags. Nobody had ever attempted any project like that before, and we didn't know whether we could accomplish it or not.
It was a tremendous grassroots effort. Tree planters joined by Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, prison inmates, and people from the farms and the cities. School children by the busload planted a million trees. The Rear family alone planted more than 100,000. In all, more than 72 million seedlings were planted. In the late 1940s, helicopters were a newfangled unknown and had never been used in forestry. Daring pilots and innovative foresters ventured their use for aerial seeding the Tillamook.
This was at the beginning of artificial reforestation, and there wasn't any formula for dealing with anything of this scope. It required developing new techniques in all phases, and we had a lot of freedom to innovate and work. To take on a problem of this scope, it was unheard of.
Over 1 billion seeds were dispersed by helicopter. With this method, seeding was quick and reached steep, inaccessible slopes. The Tillamook became an immense forest laboratory. From inventing planting tools to creating seed nurseries, the Oregon Department of Forestry pioneered new technology. But when the brush and ferns grew back, it didn't look like any good had been done at all.
My boss and his boss, after having driven through some of the areas that we had been reforesting, and he came back to the office and said, I've just been all through the project areas and says, I don't see any trees. Where are the trees? And, of course, the bracken fern was about 4 feet tall, and the trees were there underneath the fern. And I had to get our stocking survey plats out and show him, and then I had to recommend that if he really wanted to see the trees, he had to get out of the car and dig underneath the bracken fern.
Well, it seemed like it took about 10 years for those little seedlings to start showing up where you could just drive down the road and see them. It looked like we were finally getting the job done at that point.
From a burned over area of 250,000 acres, we created a forest. We planted like 72 million trees over a 23-year period and accomplished this size forest.
It's seldom in a man's lifetime that he's able to see something like this happen.
To this day, the Tillamook's 400-square-mile sea of green stands as the greatest single forest reclamation effort in the world. In 1970.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Isn't that a great video? Each one of the legislators should have been delivered a copy of this, and if you can find it in your files, take it home and watch it. It's very, very inspiring videotape. First of all, you recognize that something that was totally destroyed, in fact, can be rehabbed, become a productive forest again. About a year and a half ago, I asked one of our committee administrators to research the Tillamook for me, and you're going to have a copy of that report in just a bit. It's being duplicated back at our office. And in that report, Ray Kelly talked about the original agreements and what was supposed to happen. This is, in fact, a production forest for the purpose of yielding revenue, schools, roads for the counties that, in fact, turned over control of that sea of green, which at that time was a sea City of Brown to the Oregon State Forest, Forestry. The point that I'd like to make is that that forest is in trouble. The very fact that you saw, they didn't understand the seed zoning when that was forest was reforested, and the burn forest was reforested. What happened was is that they were using any seed stock, any trees they could get from anywhere. And so that is a condition that we have created in which we have trees that don't belong where they are. And we went back primarily with Douglas fir, and of course the natural forest was quite a mix of trees. The suggestion that we have, and I really thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this issue, because it is so critical that we not end up with another set of circumstances in the future in which the Tillamook Forest looks like those first pictures of absolute destruction. I can tell you I personally experienced a Swiss needle cast Doug fir on my own property catching fire, and it's a frightening thing to see because the tree is basically dehydrated by the disease, and it burns as if it was sprayed with gasoline. The best way to describe it would be a very dry Christmas tree put into a burn barrel, and that's how the tree burned. It still had needles on it, but as you're going to probably hear other folks talk about, the forest is in bad health. What we're saying is that we need a time certain to accomplish this and to begin an orderly process of harvesting this forest, particularly, and the decisions will be made, of course, by the experts, to take the areas that are the most poor condition. Now, I had an interesting experience also about a year and a half ago to talk with some of our local nursery stock producers, the folks who produce the trees that should be planted in the Tillamook Forest. One of the interesting things that I found as we looked up to the wall to the seed zone chart is we realized, I asked the question of this individual, do we produce all of the seed stock necessary right now, the seedling trees, to replant the Tillamook with the properly zoned trees? And the answer was, yes, we do. Now, what it would take would be a gradual ramp up to produce those kind of quantities. And so we have the good news of benefiting not only the local jurisdictions, the states, and the schools by an orderly harvest, but reestablishing again a very, very healthy forest that in fact has properly zoned species in the proper areas, which would be a great benefit. Another thing that we discovered in the research was the fact that we had probably $4 billion worth of timber value, between 2 and 4 billion. There's kind of a conflict of vision. Now, what that means is that's basically the stumpage value, but what happens if you put it through the multiplier? You could have $40 billion worth of economic good that would occur with an orderly harvest and replanting with properly zoned species. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, but I am so thankful that you are viewing this issue, because my fear, as a person who has flown over that forest in my own personal aircraft and have looked at this forest, I worry that, in fact, we could have a repeat of the early video that you saw there with absolutely total devastation, because this is a sick and dying forest. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator George, you you know that there's a number out there about the amount of acreage infected with Swiss needle cast. How much would you say is infected with Swiss needle cast?
Well, I think if you look at that forest, it isn't just Swiss needle cast. It's the fact that you have trees that are planted where they don't belong. And you have seed stock that came out of Canada, from Idaho, from other parts of Oregon. They just don't really belong being planted there. Now, I'm going to give you an example of my opinion of the forest. From going back, and I was through that forest in the early 50s as a young person, and was just marveled at the absolute devastation. And then to see today and to rejoice as we have seen that forest begin to regrow and then see these beautiful trees, what you'll notice is you'll see trees in there that are 3 and 4 feet in diameter, and other trees that were planted at the same time that are 1.5 or 2 feet in diameter. And what you're probably seeing is miszoned tree species. What I'm concerned about myself is that, in fact, those trees are in an unhealthy condition. And Roger and I both are tree growers, so we'll tell you that any tree that's under stress is susceptible to any kind of attack from any kind of disease or insect attack. And so the main problem we're facing here is that I would consider that the bulk of the Tillamook is in danger because of the fact of miszoning. It's just not, it was improperly planted. Now, they didn't know, and they did a wonderful job, as you're seeing. This is a beautiful forest, but it's a forest in trouble. And I believe what we can do, if you think about a 40-year period or something like that of an orderly harvest, you start off with the worst and you replant that. I have trees right now on my farm that 20 years ago, it was a bull pasture, okay? And it's not even the kind of soils and the kind of environment, because it's valley area, Willamette Valley area, that we have growing conditions in the Tillamook. In other words, it's nothing like the Tillamook as far as productive potential. Those trees today, in fact, Roger's brother may actually, Senator Byers' brother may actually be doing some thinning for us. And even though this is not in the most perfect place to plant the trees because it's some marginal soil for forestry, you're now seeing trees that can be harvested at 20, 25 years. So what I'm saying to you is, though, is that those trees before, that was bare ground just like the Tillamook, and now it's a beautiful young forest. It needs to be managed, and it needs to be managed now in such a way as to deal with what I believe is the really potential threat. And every time I think about, you know, terrorist activity, and I look at that forest on a hot, dry day, I think, oh my goodness sakes, what if someone decided to do that? And so for many reasons, including the fact of helping the children, helping the health of that forest, I think we need some sort of process developed that will, in fact, provide an orderly harvest and replanting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I appreciate very thoughtful testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ringo is here as well to present his bill. So we've heard Senator George's concepts on Senate Bill 699 and now yours on Senate Bill 430. Thank you for coming this morning, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Senator Keel, Senator Byer. For the record, Senator Carly Ringo, District 17, I kind of wanted to see the rest of that movie. I thought it would have been fun to see that. You know,
we all have a copy of it.
Okay.
So go find it.
I'm here in support of Senate Bill 430, which would change the management structure for half of the Tillamook Forest. And underlying that bill is the philosophy that the forest could serve many purposes and many people in the state. And that we can have a broad variety of uses in the forest, not just the focus on timber production. The week before last, I took my family for a hike in the Tillamook Forest. We drove out there about 35 minutes from my home to a place called Wolf Creek, which was right along the road, and got out and went for a hike along a nice trail down by a very, very beautiful creek. This is only about 35 minutes from my home, just within striking distance of the 470,000 people who live in Washington County, a little bit further from the million people who live in Multnomah County. And the thing that I found surprising about this was that this is really a lovely place on state land, and yet there was no improvement to it at all to attract people to go there. There was absolutely no improved parking lot. The only place to park was on the shoulder of the road. There were no picnic tables, no restrooms of any kind. And it seems tragic to me that the forest is not managed with that use in mind. My opinion, the state forest belongs to the citizens of the state. And it should serve the values of timber production as one of the uses, but also recreation, water quality, habitat protection. And I think all of these uses can be fulfilled together and not for the exclusive use or the leading use of the timber industry. And that's what Senate Bill 430 gets to. It says, look, let's take half the forest and let the Department of Forestry manage it with a focus on timber production as they do right now. That's fine. Let's take the other half and say we're going to give greater weight to the other uses. And that's not to say that they will not cut trees. And I would not support that. And when the proponents of this bill came to talk to me about it, I said I would oppose that bill. Because I am a proponent of timber production in the Tillamook. I am not a proponent of timber production, though, when it means to the exclusion of other uses. So I think it's appropriate that we say half the forest, fine, we're really going to focus on timber production, and the other half, we're going to give greater weight to these other values. After all, those lands do belong to the people of the state of Oregon. They don't belong to the timber industry. Now, I understand there was some testimony on Monday about the trust arrangement and the fact that these lands were deeded to the state in trust for the counties, and that's absolutely true. And the state forester will tell you that that is... the details of that are somewhat unclear, but the Supreme Court has said that it is not required that they maximize the revenue from the timber harvest. That was not included when they said that they would manage the forest in trust for the counties. So it's not just putting a dollar figure on it, and it does recognize that they can manage the forest for a wide variety of uses. One of my concerns on managing the Tillamook Forest is that if we were to lock it up, so to speak, that it would impact the revenues flowing to the counties and to the schools that depend on it. And as somebody who's worked hard to protect the environment, I always chafe when it gets into say the environment versus people argument, because I think protecting the environment is about working for people. And this bill is designed so that it would not take funds away from schools or from the county governments, from Tillamook or Clatsop County government, because that would not be my desire as well. I don't want this to be an owls versus people debate. I would choose people every time. But to me, protecting the environment is all about carrying out the wishes of the people and managing the forest for the benefit of the people who live in the state. So that's why I've introduced the bill. I appreciate your consideration of it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Ringo, I asked Senator George some questions that immediately showed my ignorance. Maybe I'll be doing the same thing when I ask you a question. The theme that we heard more than anything else the other day when we had 3 hours of hearing was, you know, one perspective, it kind of said, you know, we're locking up half the forest and we can't get to it. We can't. And then the other side was saying, no, we're not locking it up. We're just saying that the values of environment and habitat and recreation have to be either more highly weighed or equally weighed. And so it's not clear at all what you mean or what the other proponents mean when they say you're not against harvest totally. How do you do that? What restrictions are you talking about? I'm just asking for a little more flesh. Again, maybe I'm showing my ignorance.
No, that's fine. I think the difficulty is in a bill like this, you don't want to get overly detailed in terms of prescribing how timber harvest will be managed. I think you should leave that to the Department of Forestry. That in the late 90s, they went through extensive hearings to arrive at the leading use rule. And that's the buzzword, leading use, where timber harvest is the leading use of the state forest. And that's not to the full exclusion of the other uses, but it gives it the top priority. And so this bill would ask the Department of Forestry to say, okay, you designate half the forest where timber production will not be the leading use, and you will give greater weight to those other uses. And this bill does not specify exactly how that shall be done, because frankly I think there has to be the flexibility given to the Department of Forestry in that regard. So I can't really be more specific, but I can tell you that, as I said, when the proponents of this bill came to me and it was written a little differently, I said I opposed the bill because it seemed like it would go too far in terms of preventing timber harvest in this half of the forest. And that is not my intention at all. I vehemently oppose Senator George's theory that we need to cut the forest every 40 years. I mean, ODF has the structured base management, which envisions a variety of forest ages. And to me, that makes sense, that there should be some older forests for some habitat, younger forests, and have very, very long rotations. But I think we need to allow the Department of Forestry more flexibility. We have to give them flexibility in managing the land.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not an attorney, you are, but you, so you know well more than I do that.
But he chases ambulances when their lights don't work, he told me.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
So maybe. And when they're moving, too.
I find it interesting the wording of the bill, you know, talking about that the state forester may allow timber to be harvested in protected areas when harvesting practices do not conflict with the goal of protecting non-consumptive uses. Then you define non-consumptive uses as below. Yet, in the environment that we live in, and knowing that what the federal government is has gone through in the last 10 years, specifically the last couple of years, trying to sell some timber and being tied up in court constantly. How in the world, with this language, could you ever get a timber sale in the protected areas? Because, I mean, you and I both know that with anything that does not, you know, maintain biodiversity, protecting fish and wildlife species, that excludes everything, absolutely everything.
Well, if you think we can build in more flexibility, let's do it. I mean, I'm not wedded to this language, but I am dedicated to the concept that the forest needs to be managed with broader uses in mind. And as I said, I am not wedded to this language. But, you know, the example I gave, when you're in Portland and you drive to Seaside, you're driving through hundreds of thousands of state land and there's no place to pull over and park and have a picnic. I mean, that makes me angry. It really does. I mean, this is state land. When you take Highway 6 to the Tillamook, they're finally putting in a couple places. That's really beautiful areas. There's great areas through there. Why can't that be managed for a wide variety of people? I think the answer why it hasn't been is because of the timber focus. So I mean, that doesn't directly answer your question, other than to say, if you want to work on wording so that you think it's not locking it up and won't be subject to environmental lawsuits. And yet we are changing the management focus, I would be glad to work with you on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byron.
Who do we propose pays for the parking, the restrooms, the picnic tables that you would like to see in the areas out there along Highway 26 and Highway 6?
Well, we're managing a forest that's very valuable and produces a lot of income for our state, and I think there's revenue there to be had. 2 years ago, I asked the Department of Forestry for statistics as to what they spend every biennium on recreation, and their response to me was they didn't know because they couldn't tell. Their budget, it was lumped together with education and with law enforcement, and I said, I just want to know how much you spend on recreation. And they could not tell me. And I met with a state forester yesterday, and he said he thinks that they're working to break that figure out. I think it's a very small percent of what their overall budget is, though, and I think that it warrants knowing what that figure is, so at least we might say, gee, maybe it should be a little more.
So I guess, to answer my question, you think the money for these parks should come out of the timber harvest dollars?
I think as well as I do that the timber harvest dollars go to a variety of purposes. I mean, the parts go to the county, some of it comes to the state. The ODF budget 2 years ago was more than $200 million. A lot of it went back to fire suppression. I'm just saying that I think they need to manage the forest for a wide variety of uses. It's not unreasonable to ask them to pave a little parking lot and put in a few picnic tables.
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate what you're saying. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, unfortunately, Senator, you aren't old enough to remember back in 26 before ODOT had gone hog wild. You could pull off any place you wanted and have a picnic and didn't have to be paved and didn't have to have a bunch of picnic tables or anything else. It could be done very, very cheaply, and it's not the loggers that ask for that. It's ODOT.
I can beat up on ODOT if you want to, Senator Fisher, but I don't think that's why we're here.
All we got to do is pull a few guardrails out and leave people a little chance to get off the road.
I would respond to Senator George's comment about the Swiss needle cast. I mean, that is a serious issue, and I don't think anybody, whether it's the industry or environmentalists, want an unhealthy forest. And I think we need to manage it very carefully for disease.
One of the questions that's certainly central to everything else is the economics of the equation. Senator Meyer was referring to that, and lots of people testifying. And I've been trying hard to read the stack of material that I got on Monday from every source that's come in, and I've been balanced. I've been reading both sides of everything I can, but it's very hard to define the economics and the value of recreation hiking.
That's right.
And so on. Is there any effort out there? I mean, I saw one quote that said that a trip into the forest for a hunter had a value of $191. I don't know how they arrived at that figure. I'm
not familiar with them, but I know there have been studies. It's the same with guided fishing trips. When people take they're on a guided, say, steelheading trip, the Trask, the Wilson River, somewhere over there, what that puts into the economy.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth exploring. I think realistically the value of the timber is it overwhelms that quite a bit. But I haven't seen the study.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Senator Ringer. I appreciate your coming and sharing. We have a lot of other people that want to testify.
I had a question about ambulances in the forest, but I better not ask it.
Glad you could join us, Senator Corcoran. Tom Wolf from Trout Unlimited is the first person who's signed up. And again, I'm going to try to do the same as I did. Come on up, Tom. The other day, as long as I can go back and forth with yeses and noes, for and against, right now I'm on a list of Senate Bill 430, which has most of the people. We'll go back and forth. So, mostly in the order that you've signed up. Tom?
Chair Shields, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm the Oregon Council Chair of Trout Unlimited. I turned in testimony with four reasons for supporting SB 430, which Trout Unlimited does. Some of our main concerns are habitat for wild salmon and sea lion. I'm not sure if you're aware, but the in the Tillamook Forest, some of the healthiest runs of wild fish, particularly fall Chinook, are found and have been thriving for years. And we're concerned that not enough protection will be afforded to these fish in the future. And we believe that SB 430 will provide protection. We're also concerned about a particular stream, the Salmonberry River, which is a tributary to the Nehalem, which is the most pristine river probably on the coast. It's for many reasons it's protected for most of its length. It has a tremendous run of wild winter steelhead that not only is large in numbers but features fish that are over 20 pounds, and it's a remarkable river, and we're worried about what will happen to that stream if there isn't some sort of protection, and also water quality. I sit on the Tualatin, I'm the chair of the Tualatin Watershed Council, and right now we're looking at future sources of water for the Tualatin Basin in the next 50 years, and one of the main probably the main source that's being looked at is raising Henry Hague Lake by 20 to 40 feet, and the tributaries that flow into Henry Hague Lake come out of the Tillamook State Forest, so we're really concerned about protecting the quality of the water that will be used by the residents of the Tualatin Basin. And lastly, recreation. Like Senator Ringo, I live about 25 to 30 minutes from the Tillamook State Forest in the city of Hillsborough, as do the majority of the people in Washington County, and it's always struck me as remarkable that we have this potential recreational area that is 30 to 60 minutes away from most of the residents in the county, whereas the Cascades are anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours away, and yet the majority of people go up to the Cascades to recreate, and I believe that the Tillamook State Forest has a tremendous potential for recreation that is not being used. And I don't have any figures for what that economic benefit of recreation is, but I know that it would be a lot. And as a sixth-generation Oregonian, I worry a lot about what's going to happen in the future for people to recreate. I worry about where the people of Washington County are going to do their vacation, and I think it's unrealistic for us not to consider that recreation needs of the 475,000 people in the basin shouldn't have some consideration in our future management plans for Tillamook Forest. And with that, I'll end my testimony, and I thank you very much for this chance to come before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
No.
Roger?
Thank you.
Senator Byer?
Why is it you think that
timber harvest or commercial use and recreational use are two competing interests. Why is it you don't think that people can recreate and manage forests?
Well, I don't think, you know, again, SB, well, I'm not, Trout Limited and myself, we're not against timber harvest, but we believe that timber harvest has been the major focus, and there hasn't been development of trails, there hasn't been development of picnic timber. I'm not saying that you can't have both, but I don't believe that the management plans of the Tillamook Forest have tried to concentrate on recreation. I believe that you can manage forests and have recreation. I believe that with all my heart that's possible. I just don't believe it's being done to the best possible ability right now.
Follow-up?
Yes, Senator Byer.
I guess with that testimony you just gave, then why is it that you're the bill, and you, obviously you didn't write the bill, but you're here in support of the bill, why is it you did not focus on, rather than saying 50% of the forest will be used for non-commercial uses, why did you not focus on directing the Department of Forestry to develop trails, or use some dollars from the harvest of the timber on the entire forest to develop trails and recreation areas?
You know, that's a very good question, and I had nothing to do with the bill whatsoever, and I'm just here to support it. But certainly if some sort of language like that could be worked out, I would support it. I'm just, like I said, I'm here to support the concept of SB 430, and obviously there's a lot of language that needs to be worked out, and I would like to see that sort of language worked in where we can have both timber harvest and recreation. And obviously there's a lot of work that needs to be done on a bill like this, and I'm not opposed to language such as you suggest.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer.
I apologize for missing the Forestry Department's testimony on Monday, but I find it interesting that also the bill says, you know, when determined areas under to be protected, critical fish habitat, wildlife, drinking water, or trees that survive the forest fire, the big burns. How are you going to choose? Because when you include all four of those, you've locked up the entire forest. So then how are you going to choose which half of the forest is more important than the other half? Because those four encompass the entire forest. And I mean, and you testify specifically on the Salmonberry River, and I guess I would argue that if I'm managing the forest under these constraints, I'd probably have to go log the Salmonberry River, because obviously it's doing well, and these other rivers may be in worse shape, so we need to save those more than the Salmonberry River.
Well, I believe that you can log in those basins without harming the habitat. I think you have to be careful how you log. I don't believe that you have to just ignore the Salmonberry. I think that you can log in there. I'm not talking about just absolutely banning logging there. I'm just saying that log that leaves large buffers, log so that you don't just rip out, clear cut tall slopes that empty into streams. There's all sorts of ways you can do it. I believe, and I'm not a forester, my specific area is fisheries, but I believe there are ways that you can do both. I mean, I think that sometimes we get scared when we see a bill like this. This means that the forest is just going to be locked up and we're just going to concentrate on recreation. But I believe that if we work together, both trying to focus on the best solution for all, I think we can come up with the best possible solution. I don't know if that answers your question, but
thank you, Mr. Chair. It does. It answers my question very well, and I appreciate it. Okay. Saying we can log in critical fish habitats and not harm the rivers. That was a beautiful testimony.
Thank you. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I would just wonder what part of the Forest Service or the Department of Forestry testimony didn't speak to that very issue. Exactly what they're trying to do is to do a little logging in there and still maintain the quality. And I didn't see anything offensive at all about their testimony.
Senator Fisher, Chair Shields, having not heard that, I couldn't really answer. But let me just say that I work primarily with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is a group of wonderful people, but they're a bureaucracy. Bureaucracies move rather slowly and cumbersomely, and I believe that there are ways that we can do it that would work better, and bureaucracies don't change fast. I mean, they may want to. There may be people in Department of Forestry that do want to, but I believe that we need to provide some sort of plan that will deal with the concerns of recreationalists, environmentalists, and water quality specialists. And I believe that we need something a little bit more dynamic than what the Department of Forestry is. And I believe that we should get together and talk with the Department of Forestry, all those concerns, and address our concerns. I don't believe that we should just leave them out or not try to talk with them about those questions. I mean, we need to have dialogue, and I'm certainly not opposed to the environmental community having a dialogue with the Department of Forestry so we can address our concerns.
Let me make a statement. I want us to be very careful during the hearing this morning that what we ask for is for witnesses to give us information and clarify. I don't want to get into interrogating a person. For instance, I know you weren't here to hear the Forest Service, so it is unfair to ask that question of you since you weren't here. And I don't want you to go away feeling like this committee's beating up on you. That's not the point. So with that having said, Senator Fisher, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I happen to know that the Department of Forestry made efforts and had meetings all over the place. And they didn't do this thing in a vacuum. And it's not just the testimony that was here 2 days ago that this man evidently missed. Apparently he missed a whole bunch of other meetings too.
No, I actually attended many of those meetings, and I think that they're moving in the right way, but I still think they need to move farther.
Well, I'm sure the logging community thinks they need to move
forward. Oh, obviously, and considering that out of the six generations of my family, five of them were loggers, so I understand that, and I certainly don't want to see the logging community suffer, but I also believe that we have a duty to the future of this state to meet some of our needs as far as fish, wildlife, and recreation.
Tom, I appreciate your testimony. I really do. Six generations of your family and five have been logging, so obviously you've got some background in history. I just appreciate you coming and sharing. This is an emotional issue, and I want to shed as much light on the subject as possible with as little heat as possible this morning. So thank you for coming. As I've continued to say throughout this, we're doing pro and for and against Senate Bill 430. I'm going to ask Ray Wilkerson and Dave Ivanhoff if they'll come up now. They're in the against position. And want to welcome you to the hearing. Gentlemen, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and we represent private forest landowners. With me today is Dave Ivanhoff. Dave is a member of our board of directors. Actually, he's the chairman of our board of directors. He's here today to speak on behalf of his company, Hampton Affiliates, on some perspective on the subject at hand. And I'll ask him to go first and talk a little bit about the how he sees the state foresters plan, and then I would like to make a few comments about how the state management compares with typical management on private forest land. We would agree, Mr. Chairman, with your initial characterization of this hearing as two bills that are bookends. And I think there's a lot of room in between the bookends, and an examination of this subject is timely and warranted by the legislature. We've been struck this session by the number of legislators who have approached us with asking questions about state forest land and what the potential outputs are. There seems to be quite a bit of interest in the building about that. So I think these hearings and examining that space in between these bookends is very valuable. I think the best, from our perspective, the best place to have that examination or to start is to look at the status quo, which is how the state is currently managing those lands, make a judgment. You folks need to make a judgment about whether they're on the right track, the wrong track. or and whether some modification might be needed. So again, we have some questions and concerns about the state's current approach, both and whether or not they're meeting their own expectations, and then when you compare their approach to some of the things we're doing, I think it raises some additional questions. So with that, I'd like to let Dave Ivanoff talk about how he sees this from his company's perspective.
Well, good morning, Chair Shields and member of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates, and in that capacity, I'm the person responsible for the procurement of the raw material needed to support our Willamina and Tillamook sawmill operations. I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 430 and also to support the Department of Forestry's Forest Management Plan that was passed in January of 2001, but to also request some significant changes to the implementation plans that are part of that forest management plan. By way of background, the planning process on these lands began in 1994, and I've had the privilege of being involved in that effort by testifying on numerous occasions to the Department of Forestry at public meetings as well as in front of the Board of Forestry. As the department indicated yesterday, the management strategy on these lands are consistent with a silvicultural process called structure-based management that is designed to create complex forest structures over time, with about 50% of the land base grown to older age classes, anywhere from 90 to 130 years in age, to essentially replicate old growth stand characteristics in that period of time. This is a new strategy that I've not presently, that I had not previously been exposed to, but at numerous opportunities for public comment and question, the department indicated that this strategy would very closely replicate the outputs under a more traditional even age management scenario. This was the same input that was given to the counties as well. OFIC and the counties gave conditional support to this strategy pending the department's ability to produce on the promises that were being made in terms of what the output potential was. After about 5 years of the process, the department finally, at the request of the counties, did an economic analysis of this silvicultural strategy. Dr. John Sessions of Oregon State University was retained by the department to do a complex spatial modeling exercise across this landscape and illustrate the outputs under these different management strategies. Dr. Sessions is a world-renowned expert in forest modeling, and he was able, through very complex computer-aided technology, develop a whole variety of alternatives. Ultimately, the problems with the Swiss needle cast became part of the strategy in that the conversion of the Swiss needle cast areas to disease-resistant species was given a high priority, but also the active management of the rest of the landscape was going to transpire as well. This alternative was essentially a compromise that resulted from the county's input and desire for more revenue and the department's desire to create these complex stand structures over time. This alternative became known as Alternative 1, Option C2, and the Board of Forestry approved this alternative in January of 2001. Dr. Sessions' Alternative 1, Option C2, is designed to maximize present net value, but at the same time achieve the environmental protection for water quality, wildlife habitat, etc., and to develop these complex forest structures over time. It's important to note that in Dr. Sessions' modeling exercise, he predicted outputs from these state lands would start out in the first decade at about 279 million feet per year and proceed gradually up to a level of 340 to 350 million feet 4 or 5 decades out. Now, my experience as an industrial forester managing similar type property would lead me to believe that on a traditional even age management approach on 500,000 acres in the Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook districts, we ought to be able to generate somewhere around 330 to 350 million feet a year. Structure-based management is costing the citizens of this state about 50 million feet a year in outputs. At an average of a $300 stumpage rate, that's $15 million a year that structure-based management is costing. But the the approval of the Board of Forestry of this alternative one, option C2, was nevertheless a compromise as a result of the hard work by well-intentioned people from all different perspectives, including the environmental community, the counties, and the timber industry and OFIC. It is not what I would have liked to have seen, but nevertheless, it was a compromise. And when the Board of Forestry approved this management plan in January of 2001, I actually had a state of euphoria that this long process was finally over and that we had reached a compromise that, while it was not what anybody would have liked on a standalone basis, it nevertheless represented all the perspectives of everybody that was involved. In June of 2001, 6 months after the board approved this, the implementation plans came out, and to my absolute dismay, the initial implementation plans put out by the department showed harvest levels on those three districts to be at about $145 million a year. That was actually slightly less than what they've done in the last two fiscal years, and about 50% of what Dr. Sessions modeled. The counties obviously weighed in heavily at that point and retained Mark Rasmussen of Mason, Bruce, and Girard, who testified with the counties on Monday of this week. Mark Rasmussen is also an expert in forest modeling, and he took a hard look at the implementation strategies and the work that Dr. Sessions did. And Mark Rasmussen has been able to say to the counties that with some changes in the department strategies, totally consistent with the forest management plan, that they indeed could achieve harvest levels of Dr. Sessions' nature. The department has approved those implementation plans, and as a result of the county's effort over the last year and a half, the department's mid-range outputs are now at 179 million feet as opposed to the 145 that they started with, again, on those three North Coast districts. That's still 100 million feet short of what Dr. Sessions modeled and what we believe is attainable on that landscape. I believe that the department's unwillingness to move beyond these levels that they currently plan to harvest to is due to a lack of expertise within the department to develop a complex spatial model and to have confidence in this. I think the department is erring on the side of being overly conservative because they don't have that technical expertise. And also, if you look closely at the implementation plans, they are absolutely not in 100% strategical and tactical alignment with the strategies embodied within Alternative 1, Option C2, and the Board of Forestry specifically stated in its intent statement that you will manage according to these strategies. Again, Dr. Sessions' model maximizes present net value while still achieving the social, environmental, and economic benefits of the land. If I could, I'd like to turn now to the spreadsheet that I passed out, and if I could just draw your attention to the portion of the spreadsheet that talks about issues relative to the forest management plan. Under item one, this is a tabular display of the high and the low ranges of the outputs contemplated by the department, with the average being at 179 as highlighted in yellow. Item two is designed to illustrate what the economic impact of this implementation strategy is costing the citizens of this state. In addition to the $15 million that's costing the state to just manage according to structure-based management, we believe it's going to cost another $30 million to not implement to the full levels of Dr. Sessions' model. About $19.2 million of that $30 million shortfall would be going to the counties, and to the extent some of that general fund money that goes to the counties currently could be replaced with these higher timber dollars from the sale of the state timber, that would be an offset to general fund that could go elsewhere in the state. The department would receive about $11 million more annually to support department programs, and while there certainly would be some of that cost or some of that revenue needed to put up additional timber sales, through the economies of scale, the unit cost of putting up additional volume would go down, and I believe through legislation, other department programs such as fire protection, service forestry, that sort of thing could be funded out of this incremental revenue. Finally, what I'd like to talk about is, just as a professional forester, you kind of go through a reality check on any kind of a modeling exercise, and you want to see, does Dr. Sessions' 279 million feet a year off of this land base make sense? There's rules of thumb about growth on the forest. And in an age class that this forest is in, if you assume 1,100 board feet per acre per year on the 80% of the land base that is commercial forestry, and then I discounted that by a factor of 25% to account for the needle cast portion of this landscape, you can see the projected growth is $333 million a year. The department would argue that there's an issue about the inventory on the land base. It could either be 9 billion feet or 13 billion feet. And Dr. Sessions modeled his work around the 13 billion foot scenario. But again, Mark Rasmussen, in his analysis for the county, suggested that notwithstanding the difference in the inventory levels, Dr. Sessions' numbers are still achievable. And indeed, if you look at 4.5% growth rate on 9 billion feet, again, discounted by 25%, you're over 300 million feet. If we've got 13 billion feet out there, you're over 439 billion feet. Mark Rasmussen on Monday testified that the biological potential of this land base is about 493 million feet a year. So the reality is that if you're going to manage a large land base and practice sustainable forestry, you don't want to be harvesting on a long-term basis in excess of growth. You can see Dr. Sessions' number at 279 million feet is clearly lower than what the forest is growing. To the extent that there's a trust responsibility to the counties, I believe that it's important to look at the management of these lands from a business standpoint as well. If you take a conservative current fair market valuation of that land base, I used the figure of 9 billion feet and used the average stumpage rate of 302.52 from fiscal 2002. It comes up with a retail value on the timber of $2.7 billion. With the land value at $250 an acre, the current retail value on the most conservative estimate of volume out there is $2.8 billion. Discounting that by a factor of 35% to be consistent with what a large institutional or industrial owner would probably spend on that property, the current fair market value on a wholesale basis would be about $1.8 billion. On a meager 5% return on that asset value, that would be $92.5 million a year. Again, divided by the average stumpage rate, comes out to $306 million a year. That's, again, consistent with Dr. Sessions' numbers being very reasonable. What does this plan mean to Hampton and our companies? As I indicated earlier, our Willamina and Tillamook sawmills depend heavily on state timber as an integral part of our raw material mix. Following the devastating wildfires 60 and 70 years ago, these lands were planted for the purpose of generating abundant timber outputs and revenue flow for the citizens of the state and the trust counties. With the lack of a federal timber sale program in this state, the outputs from these state lands are incredibly important to timber-dependent communities that Governor Kulongowski has said is important that the rural economies of this state be restored. Our Willamina and Tillamook mills provide about 522 jobs to the community, and our annual payroll is over $29 million. Parts and supplies to support those operations bring another $9 million into the economy, and we estimate the contractors we employ provide that same economic contribution to the state. The Hampton family has invested a huge sum of money into these businesses over the last 50 years, and the outputs from these state lands are critically important to our company, our employees, and the communities in which we operate. And finally, the last point I'd like to make is Oregon is right now on the verge of insolvency. It's incredibly important, in my view, to actively manage the assets that we have. And Dr. Sessions' model and the implementation plans change to Dr. Sessions' levels, Dr. Sessions' type outputs, would not only restore the economic well-being of those rural timber-dependent communities, but also the overall economic well-being of the state. I don't believe that we are going to suffer the loss of recreation opportunities, wildlife habitat, etc. Again, Dr. Sessions' plan and the plan that the board approved is a consensus or a compromise that is designed to take care of all the economic and social aspects of how these lands should be managed. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Byers has indicated he has a question.
Thank you. Actually, I have a couple of questions. First, do you know how much was actually sold in year 2002 there? You said that they came up with a plan for 179 million feet at the, you know, late 2001. How much did the state forestry actually sell off the Tillamook in 2002?
Senator Beyer, I don't have that number with me, but I can certainly get it for you. It is less than the 179 that they're currently planning to sell to.
I'm sure the forestry department can give me that number. You don't need to do that. Another question. I see your 4.5% growth factor on your rule of thumb estimate, and to me, that seems extremely low. What land class is this talking about? Isn't this mostly class one?
Senator Beyer, these lands are some of the highest site lands in the world in terms of forestry. And what I was trying to do here by using a factor of 4.5% was to take a conservative approach and not damage my credibility by overstating the growth. Again, I make reference to Mark Rasmussen's testimony on Monday that the biological potential of this land is actually closer to 493 million feet as opposed to the 333 million that are on the low end of my estimate. So, again, the point I'm trying to make is that I'm trying to be conservative and realistic, and I agree with you that 4.5% is a relatively low growth rate on lands of this site quality. It's probably closer to 5.5 or 6%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more.
Senator Beyer.
For your own lands, what growth factor would you use on those when you're figuring your annual harvest, just out of curiosity, compared to 4.5%?
The 1,100 board feet per acre per year in these age classes and site quality is consistent with what we experience on our own lands.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for our own forest land that we manage, which is on the east side of the valley, which is not nearly as productive as lands as this, and we actively manage it, which is going to help production, but we personally use a 5% growth factor for our own lands, and I don't believe we are being overly aggressive in that number, and we're not discounting it by 75% for Swiss needle cast, but we also don't have Swiss needle cast like
right.
They do there.
I appreciate your statements. Are there any other questions? I'd want to thank you very much for coming. It may take me a while to figure out this whole sheet. Mathematics was never my high point, but
it's actually very well laid out. Appreciate
it. It's very well done. Very well done.
Mr. Chairman, if I could then just briefly summarize some of the points that are in that handout that we provided on state forest land overview. And basically what we're trying to do there is contrast how the state's approach to managing these lands contrasts with how a typical similarly situated private landowner under the Forest Practices Act manages private forest lands. I need to, as a caveat before I do that, let you know that OFIC has a diverse membership, and some members have manufacturing facilities, some don't. Some would benefit from higher outputs off estate timberlands, some wouldn't. So for that reason, we're not here to advocate any particular position or a particular outcome, but we're just to provide information and contrast what we do compared to what the state's currently doing. I think the place to start with that, I know Senator Shields, I'm not sure the other senators, was on the Natural Resource Interim Committee this past interim, and one hearing the Department of Forestry presented some good information, just kind of an assessment of Oregon's forests, and part of that was to some data that they developed to compare growth with harvest based on ownership, federal, state, and private. And on private land, the ratio is pretty close to 1-to-1. Anything above 1-to-1 is sustainable. We harvest almost as much as we grow. On the state forest land, that same ratio is 3.3-to-1. So what that says is that for every less than one-third of the annual increase in growth each year on state forest land is realized in terms of harvest and revenue to the state and the counties. Part of the reason for that, not the only reason, is the way the state manages the more conservative management that we've been talking about for the last couple of days. I think there's basically three differences I'd like to highlight between how we typically manage our lands and how the state is doing it. One, the first one is longer rotations. We've heard that means a longer period of time between harvests. There's been a lot of numbers thrown around in the last couple of days, and I won't go through this in any detail, but attached to the handout that we provided is a couple pages what we call a net present value analysis, and it's a hypothetical example of an acre forest land in the Potomac Forest or anywhere for that matter that currently has a 50-year-old stand of trees on it, and it compares two management approaches. One is to harvest those trees now at age 50, replant, and to get another harvest 50 years from now. Second option is to not harvest at all for another 50 years, let that current stand grow to be 100 years old, and then harvest it. And this is the kind of analysis that private timberland owners do, and what they're trying to do is find a financially optimal rotation age. And the bottom line of this analysis is the longer you hold your timber past that financially optimal rotation age, the more it's cost you money. And so that's what this spreadsheet is designed to demonstrate on a hypothetical basis, and the numbers are pretty dramatic. And the net present value of that land right now, hypothetically, if you're allowed to harvest those 50-year-old trees, is almost 10 times as much as it is the net present value would be if you were required to leave them for another 50 years. So,
can you repeat that? The last sentence.
If you own that acre and you were not allowed to harvest those 50-year-old trees for another 50 years, that would diminish the net present value of that asset by about 90%. And it's Senator Shields, you actually have to know calculus to do this right. So if I go any further, I'll be in trouble. But this is the kind of it has to do with the time value of money and compounding interest and that sort of thing. Senator Beyer probably understands this, and Dave understands it. Anyway, it's just to demonstrate. The point is, a key part of the state's plan is longer rotations than you typically see on private land, and there's a cost associated with that, and it's fairly significant. So, and it's compounded, actually, by the fact that there used to be, up until the last 10 or 20 years, a premium in the market. The market provided a premium for bigger, larger logs. Those were more valuable on a board foot basis. There's been a tremendous transformation in the industry in the last couple of decades to what we call a second growth economy. All the mills have been retooled to cut smaller logs because the old growth has basically been logged on private forest land, and on the federal land is unavailable for harvest. So the industry has gone through a tremendous technological revolution. We're doing engineered wood products. You can make panels out of sawdust and wood chips now instead of traditional plywood. So the premium for large logs doesn't exist anymore. On a board foot basis, a log, a 40-year-old log is as valuable, even more valuable than a log from a 100-year-old tree. So I think there's an additional financial risk to the state through this strategy because that previously existed premium just not there. And that phenomenon is likely to increase in the future. The second major difference between what we do and what the state's doing is the area of the protected zones on their plan. And we basically are required to follow the Forest Practices Act on private forest land, which is designed to make sure the environment is protected when private enterprise engages in logging. The state and there are certain zones on our land that we can't operate in. The primary example of that is stream buffers, the amount of trees that adjacent to a stream that are required to be left and the width of those buffers. On the state's plan for all fish-bearing streams, regardless of size, that buffer is 170 feet wide on each side of the stream. Now, that entire 170 feet is not totally off limits to harvest. Part of it is, part of it isn't, but all of it is harvest is at least restricted. Under the Forest Practices Act, that same width is either 100 feet, 70 feet, or 50 feet, depending on the size of the stream. So one way to visualize this, some of these small fish-bearing streams that just have resident cutthroat trout, not anadromous salmon, but they're classified as fish-bearing, some of them are very small. On this low flow in the summertime when those buffers are doing their job by shading and providing water temperature control, those streams often are only a couple feet wide. So if you visualize a football field with a 2-foot stream going down the 50-yard line and 170 feet on either side, you've got trees well into the end zone on both sides that are left for the purpose of protecting that 2-foot wide stream. Question for you and for the state is that cost? What's the cost-benefit analysis of leaving that behind for the purpose of protecting that stream? Does that really make sense or not? And that's the kind of hard-headed analysis, I think, that is really ought to be done here. A couple other examples of the protected zone differences. the state's plan calls is we're required also to leave some down logs after a logging operation, and the logs are just laying on the ground, have benefits for the ecosystem. Forest Practices Act standard is about 20 cubic feet per acre. The forest plan that the state has implemented is a 600 cubic feet per acre, roughly, and that's a, you know, that's a 30 times difference. Now, why is that? What is the benefit that the state is getting for that, and at what cost? Again, a cost-benefit kind of analogy. The third example would be core areas around spotted owl nests. The State Forest Practices Act requires that 70 acres around a spotted owl nest be left untouched on private land. State's similar standard is 250 acres. What's the, you know, reason for that, and what's the cost, and what's the benefit? Those are the kinds of questions we think bear examination. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, the main reason we're here today and the main concern we have about this subject matter is, what does it say about us and how we're managing our lands? We're supportive of the Forest Practices Act. We recognize our responsibility to protect public resources that occur on our lands. The standards we're required to follow are not insubstantial. When Measure 7 was on the ballot 3 years ago, which would have required compensation for the cost of regulations, part of the fiscal impact analysis the state did was, how much would it cost if everybody that has to follow the Forest Practices Act applied for compensation for the cost? And the answer was $55 million a year. And so that represents the value of the timber that we are required private landowners to leave behind each year to comply with the Forest Practices Act. The fact that the state's plan goes well beyond the Forest Practices Act suggests, or seems to suggest, that somehow that's not good enough, that what we're doing is not good enough. We reject that. We don't agree with that. If it's not, tell us what we're doing wrong, what else we need to do, and we'll do it. We have a history of being receptive to that kind of information. If it is good enough, however, how does the state justify going beyond that with an important public asset? That's the fundamental question that we think needs to be answered, and why we have such an intense interest in this subject. Finally, quickly, the third major difference is the state is trying to negotiate a habitat conservation plan for these lands with the federal agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service. That's a policy choice on their part. There's a misconception that the Federal Endangered Species Act requires more of state lands than it does of private lands. That's not the case. All non-federal lands have the same legal requirements under the Federal Endangered Species Act. If you want to take that step, if you want to try to negotiate a habitat conservation plan, which is basically a contract, you can do it, but you don't have to. You're not required to. Our members in Oregon have not done that. There are no multi-species habitat conservation plans on private land. There are Washington, California, that's happened, but not in Oregon. So we've made the policy choice not to pursue that. The state has not yet been able to consummate those arrangements. They've been negotiating for, I think, 6 years with these agencies. They've spent $2 million just in process costs to try to get down that road. And our information is there's about 40,000 acres in these forests that they would be willing to basically set aside as reserve areas in order to consummate a habitat conservation plan agreement. That's probably about four times as many acres as a private landowner would encumber based on a different approach to the Endangered Species Act, which is what we call take avoidance. Basically, you just make sure you don't violate the federal law. You manage in a way that you, if you've got occupied habitat, if you've got an owl, obviously you can't harvest. But if you've got owl habitat that's not occupied, then you do harvest that, and that's the primary difference why these acres are an example of the difference why the number of acres set aside is much higher. And then, but the point is that we are not looking to these habitat conservation plan as a management option. We could if we wanted to. We've chosen not to. The state says they're doing it for business reasons. You know, the obvious question is if it's a good business choice, why aren't the private landowners doing the same thing, and we're not? We've made a different business decision. Just to wrap up, to put a price tag on this is difficult. We've actually tried to back of the envelope add up the cost of all these factors, and because of the confusion about the inventory and other factors, it's hard to do. We roughly came up with as much as $25 million additional lost revenue to the state annually by adding these cumulative factors. Another way to look at it is the way Dave did, that these lands could easily produce another 50 million board feet a year. That would be another $15 million revenue available if they did that, and that was on top of the $30 million that we're not getting if the state can't hit its own target, which is what the point that Dave was trying to make. One final point is, attached to the testimony is a brief information about the common school fund lands. That's not the subject of these bills, and that's basically under the purview of the state land board. And the principal part of that is the Elliott State Forest in near Coos Bay. Another way to make the same point, I think, is to look at the information available there. That land, the Elliott State Forest's appraised value is $850 million. If the state sold that for $850 million, put the money in the bank at 5% interest for the Common School Fund, that would generate $42.5 million a year. The timber harvest revenue off the Elliott State Forest last year was $10 million. So they're only realizing a fourth of what they could realize if they just sold the land and drew interest on the proceeds. So that's another example where we're underutilizing a valuable state asset. These are your lands, that, particularly the County Forest Trust lands. The legislature has jurisdiction over the Tillamook State Forest. The Board of Forestry has done a lot of work with the purpose of the lands rule. It's all based on the authority you've given them through state statute. So it's the decision is up to the legislature on whether they're satisfied with that approach or think a modification might be in order. So, again, we appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Bray. I appreciate it very much. I do want to make clear to those that think I've given an inordinate amount of time to Ray and Dave that on Monday when we started, ODF was supposed to make a large presentation. The Rainforest Coalition was supposed to make a large presentation. The counties, likewise. And OFIC was supposed to do it on Monday. They graciously said, you're way overbooked today, and so you gentlemen came back today, and I thank you for coming back to make your presentation today. I do want to return to public hearing at this point, though, and try to pick up the pace. I don't know how long others can stay here, but I do know that we stayed 3 hours on Monday. And I'm prepared to stay as long as I have to today, barring the fact that there's a session starting at 11 a.m. With that, I want to call Don Fontenot. Did I mispronounce that?
No, that is correct.
And I'd like to do these two at a time. Two yeses, Chuck Willer. If both of you would come, and like I said, I've got to pick up the pace, and then I'm going to go with a no again in a few minutes. That would be Rex Storm from the Association of Oregon Loggers. So that's the order of the next three folks.
Do you want to start?
No, you go ahead, please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm here to speak.
Your name, please?
I'm Chuck Willer, okay. Director of the Coast Range Association. And I'm here to speak to the issue of drinking water as it relates to the state land management. And I do have a copy of a report we have produced for members of the committee, and I'll be leaving that with your person over here. I think it's important to step back and look at the big picture here. And there's been a lot of facts and details thrown around in the prior testimony, but the issue of drinking water and water quality really requires standing back and looking at these lands in relationship to the public's interest in the metro Portland area, and where future drinking water and current drinking water is coming from, and what this the state's land management plan means for drinking water. I'd like to start out by first stating that the Coast Range Association, a member of the Rainforest Coalition, and I've been working in forestry issues for 12 years in the Coast Range. That's my only focus, is what's going on, what are the issues in the Coast Range. And I've studied forestry, silvicultural strategies, and I'd like to note that the strategy employed by the Department of Forestry, structure-based management, is a improvement in forest strategy and is something we endorse. That being said, it's very important to understand the context by which we're supporting a large area, large areas to be protected in the state lands, and why. And drinking water is a central issue to our argument. what are the issues and what is the specifics that we need to look at, and specifics at a large, a big picture level. One, current drinking water use off these state lands is quite extensive. Numerous communities, numerous water districts, particularly Washington County, currently utilize water from catchments and watersheds that are whole or in part on the state lands. I'd like to point out that Barney Reservoir, Hard Hag Lake, two very important impoundments supplying Washington County, get their water whole or in part from state lands. And there's some music to signify how important that fact is.
There's God, Wayne.
The fact is, capacity on current water systems utilizing state land for Washington County is at near maximum. Expansion plans and processes are in place. The other source of water for Washington County and metro area, of course, is the federal lands east of the city, Bull Run specifically. That is currently under expansion considerations. The other areas would be classic, Clackamas Basin. And the third main source for drinking water for the metro area would be the Willamette River. The Willamette River filtration plant that was recently installed created a firestorm of controversy in Washington County and many cities, Tigard, etc., and people rejected that as a source of drinking water when the alternative was forested landscapes such as the state lands or the Bull Run. The future growth of Portland metro area will require a large increase in drinking water delivery and capacity. The choice is between east side lands, west state lands, or the Willamette River. And we believe that the state's management plan is seriously flawed to provide for future and current protection of drinking water source, which will be essential for the future economic health of the Portland metro area. What are the issues, and why is the state's plan flawed? The state's plan timber strategy is extensive across the landscape. It is a plan that requires active and intensive management in almost all basins, and it is a multiple entry strategy with a final clear-cut harvest. The Achilles heel on such a plan is the road system. In the Siuslaw National Forest, one of the most extensively roaded national forests in the nation, when they moved to a small diameter thinning strategy in the 90s, they had to increase their road system for the yarding systems that are employed by 10, 15, 20%. The state's plan will require a road system that will compromise water quality from basins, even though it's a silvicultural strategy that benefits terrestrial ecosystem species. The road system is the Achilles heel. The state's management plan calls for the ordinary use of herbicides. It will be an extensive application of herbicides. It will be an extensive and ongoing harvest activity over a very intensive road system. And finally, let's look at the state land landscape as compared to industrial lands in the surrounding landscape. An analysis of steep land that we looked at for the landscape north of Hebo on up to the Columbia River indicates that the preponderance, more than half of all steep land in that landscape of several million acres, is on state land. And if you look at, for example, the Weyerhaeuser lands or some of the other industrial lands, they are far gentler in terrain than the state lands. And I also would add, many areas of the state forest receive 1 to 200 inches of rain per year, often delivered in large storm events. The bottom line is that disturbance regime from an intensive forestry, no matter how well intentioned or improved over ordinary management that we find on private lands, the road system required to do small diameter, multiple thin entries on a every decade, and the kind of terrain and topography and soil of the state lands just will not provide balance for future drinking water to Metro Portland and the numerous communities that draw water off the state lands and provide for future increased capacity. Our report documents current use. I think you can appreciate what the future use will be given the growth of that area. And the idea of setting aside or protecting for drinking water, salmon habitat, and amenity recreational use 50% of the state lands is a balanced strategy, reasonable, and particularly when viewed in light of future needs and requirements, economic, social, and recreational. I'd like to finish by making two points. There are two communities that do have forest management plans for their drinking water basins, their areas that they own, Forest Grove and Scappoose. Their protective measures for their land management are quite a bit higher than the state's forest plan. Forest Grove and Scappoose plan to eliminate the use of clear-cut harvesting in their watersheds. They have larger buffers. They are phasing out or have eliminated herbicide use. This is not an unusual kind of management for municipalities that own watersheds that they use for municipal drinking water. So I'd urge the committee to take a look at our report, appreciate the facts as we've talked about the comparison of some of the municipalities, appreciate also how many communities use state lands for their water source, not just Washington County, but communities on the west side and north, and to appreciate that when you consider water use, drinking water quality, which is very closely related to salmon habitat and the water quality necessary for productive salmon runs, the state's plan is flawed in terms of its intensity of silviculture and the road system that will be needed when looked at the condition of the landscape being so much steep land. And I'd like to point out one thing in relation to prior testimony about Dr. Sessions' analysis. Dr. Sessions' analysis was never meant to be taken as absolute numbers. Those numbers are for comparison purposes between alternatives. And I think, and I believe Dr. Sessions has stated such. And I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And Donald has an additional points to be made on water.
Yes, I. Don, let's go ahead. I'm worried about us running out of time before everybody has a chance to testify this morning. I'm trying to be fair to everybody here, so let's keep moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Donald Fontenot. I'm the Outreach Director for the Tillamook Rainforest Coalition. I'm also a registered nurse in good standing here in Oregon, and I'm also a veteran of the First Iraqi War. I personally ground-truthed, meaning I've looked at, walked, checked the buffers to see what the paper of a ground-truth timber sale says compared to what it looks like on the ground. Countless number of timber sales put forward by the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Tillamook Rainforest. I have read and reread the forest management plan. I have commented on it. I have read the 10-year implementation plan, commented on it, and I continually comment on annual operation plans put forward by the Oregon Department of Forestry. I regularly attend Oregon Board of Forestry meetings, and I have testified before numerous county commissions and advisory boards. I have been involved in this process for quite some time and plan on being involved in this process for quite some time. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to come before you and briefly discuss the management of 518,000 acres of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. We call these lands the Tillamook Rainforest, and I'd like to be able to use a visual up here. I don't know if the sound's going to track me or not, about there's been some discussion about whether or not these lands are actually rainforest. And so what is a rainforest, I guess, is the first question. If I can get this map to come out, I'll kind of explain, use this map as a prop to show you what the rainforests look like here in North America. I pulled some quotes from a few biologists, and I'll just go ahead and read them. Can y'all see that?
Yes.
Well enough? Okay. Originally found almost every continent, only half of the world's coastal temperate rainforests still stand. Half of those remain in North America, and you can see this band right here. These forests exist in latitudes from about 32 degrees to 60 degrees north in a narrow band between the coast and the mountains. Rainfall there exceeds 80 inches. For the Tillamook and Clatsop, it usually exceeds over 100 inches. And in the Salmon Barrier that Tom was talking about earlier, it receives up to 200 inches of rainfall a year. The coastal temperate rainforests of North America occupy a place of central importance to the global future of these type of forests. If you look at this little shot here, it shows you where how unique these forests are. Although there are half of them are here on the west coast of North America, you see where they're scattered out throughout the world. It's a very unique ecosystem. So let me show you a map of where our Tillamook rainforests fit into here. Obviously, you can tell that that is the north coast of Oregon. Here's Astoria, Pacific Ocean, Forest Grove, and Hillsborough that get their drinking water from the Tillamook rainforest. We talked earlier about this 50% set-aside area where eventually these areas would be managed along with timber production originally for clean water, recreation, and wildlife. We've identified through U.S. Fish and Wildlife surveys of marble murrelets, spotted owls, the best fish habitat, and clean drinking water, approximately 50% of the landscape, and that's represented here in the dark green that's superimposed on all state lands, which is the gray. This is a draft map, but when people ask us where the 50% is, well, it's the most important places for fish, birds, recreation, clean water, and then the steep lands. And so that accounts for about 50,000 acres. We're 100% willing to work with the Oregon Department of Forestry in identifying these lands and using Oregon Department of Forestry's adaptive management strategy to implement this through the current forest management plan. So the forest management plan would not have to be redone, and that's one of the things that was mentioned earlier in previous testimony. If this were to be implemented, then they would have to redo the whole forest management plan, and that's simply not true. We're 100% willing to work with the department. So why are we here? We're all here because we care about Oregon. How we achieve what is best for Oregon is how we differ, and this is where the common ground is need to be found. I'm here because I have serious concerns about the implementation of the Forest Management Plan. The Forest Management Plan is a pretty good document. It has some really good goals in there. It is the implementation of that Forest Management Plan that we believe it doesn't provide the greatest permanent value for all Oregonians as required by ORS 530. Current implementation is executed through excessive clear-cutting and unneeded road building, proves even to the most untrained eye that timber production is the priority at the expense of clean drinking water, recreation, fish, and wildlife. Now, we heard a lot of testimony on Monday, and we're hearing it today, and there seems to be some misunderstandings about some very basic premises that we need to start with. We need to have the same common denominator before we can move forward. So I'd like to address a few of those misunderstandings and then use Oregon Department of Forestry records and state records statutes to kind of clarify that. And this isn't my own bias. This is just simply the facts that are coming out of these documents. Misunderstanding number one, the coalition's reserve plan will lock up 50% of the forest where no logging will be allowed. Well, Senator Beyer asked this question earlier, and he kind of answered it. But basically, nowhere in Senate Bill 430, which we support, is the word reserve mentioned. In fact, lines 17 and 18 clearly state that the forester may allow timber to be harvested in the protected areas when harvest practices do not conflict with the goal of protecting non-consumptive uses. And then you look down in lines 35 and 36, it defines non-consumptive uses, and clean water production is one of those. Misunderstanding number two, and this is probably the biggest one. Earlier testimony stated that clearly trust lands were intended to be...
Yes.
Go back
Senator
to your
Corcoran.
First premise. What do you think is the misunderstanding about that?
There was testimony that said that there would be no logging allowed inside of the 50% non-consumptive use areas. And we want to make sure that everybody understands that there is going to be timber harvesting allowed in those areas. There was a lot of testimony on Monday that said because we were going to go in and lock up and throw away the key, these forests were going to burn down and we weren't going to let anybody in there. And that was something that was repeated over and over again.
But Senator Beyer's question was, given your definition of non-consumptive uses, how could you possibly log there even if you were given permission to?
That's a very good question, and thank you for asking that. The key to this is, what is your premise for going in there and doing logging? Is it forest health? Is it for timber production and revenue production? Because the end product of that premise decides what the prescription is going to be. If your priority is revenue, then chances are you're going to go inside of there and clear cut on a large scale. If your priority is, say, improving the riparian management area, then maybe you're doing a hardwood removal to allow those big trees to get bigger faster to provide large woody debris down in the streams. Did I answer your question, Senator?
No.
That's fine.
I'm just trying to raise the point that I think Senator Beyer makes a very good point, which is that if you're setting aside 50% of the land and it's got to be used for non-consumptive uses, then you're pretty much shutting it down.
I think that you can achieve non-consumptive goals with thinning.
Okay.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay.
Again, I'm urging people to move along.
Yes, sir. Misunderstanding number two, and probably this is the biggest one, clearly trust lands were intended to be revenue-producing lands. The facts behind that don't prove that to be true. In 1997, ODF, the Board of Forestry, commissioned a study to clarify what the Supreme Court decision was on Crabtree Valley. What did that really mean? There was a lower court decision. There was a Supreme Court decision. The Board of Forestry, Department of Forestry, hired Souter and Rice to come up with clarification on that. And so I'll go ahead and cite from that study, and I'll turn in a copy to Patricia. I only have two copies. On page 8 of this study, Teresa Rice and John Souter state, statutory provisions governing Board of Forestry lands in Oregon do not use the word trust, and only recent Oregon Supreme Court decisions addressing the nature of the state's obligations has stated this obligation is defined by statute, ORS 530. They continue on page 10. The authors have reviewed the statute and find a lack of any a priori requirement to maximize or even produce revenues from every acre of 530 lands. But the statute is clear that these lands must be managed for the broad goal of obtaining the greatest permanent value to the state. And that's to the state, not to the individual counties. Now I'll read from the statute itself. ORS 530, otherwise known as the greatest permanent value, clearly states the board and the state forester are not required to manage lands to maximize revenue. The board and the state foresters are not to exclude all non-producing uses on these state forests or to produce revenue from every acre of these forest lands. And that's AOR 629-035-0010, line 4. Clearly, these lands are not required to produce revenue on every acre. Misunderstanding number three, and this kind of gets back to the road building issue. Two-thirds of the revenues from timber sales fund county governments and schools. In fact, we handed out our economic report that used numbers from Oregon Department of Forestry. On page 40, graph 4.1, the study shows that over 50% of the revenues from timber sales actually go to ODF for projects and administration. So let's look at one of these projects. The most controversial of is road building. On page 24 of the newly released 10-year implementation plan, ODF states that it plans to build 774 miles of new road in the Tillamook Rainforest over the next 10 years. Now, given that a mile of road cost about $50,000, we're looking at about $38 million in road building costs. Senator Beyer asked a question earlier, how are we going to pay for this wayside, for this trail next to Wolf Creek? Well, let's not build 1 mile of road and use that $50,000 to build that wayside. Let's not build 2 miles of road and build two waysides. The money's there, it's just where it's being prioritized. Unfortunately, it's being prioritized for road building. Now, what's the implication of this misunderstanding? This implies that the Oregon Department of Forestry has an inherent interest in maintaining their structural bureaucracy rather than achieving the greatest permanent value for all Oregonians. And my final misunderstanding. ODF has used the best available science in the formation of the Forest Management Plan. Facts. The Oregon Department of Forestry commissioned an independent scientific review of ODF's proposed Western Oregon State Forest HCP, and there was some mention of that earlier. It has some very interesting things to say, and I pulled out a few facts from the scientists that were commissioned to do this report. Dr. James Trappe says, many share the concern that ODF skews its management strategies so strongly towards the timber industry while doing the minimum necessary to comply with the law. He goes on to say on page 142, I question the implicit assumption that focus on timber production is the best management approach for the long-term good or for long-term forest health. Dr. Eric Forsman continues, I think that managing the landscape with considerable attention to patch size and structure is a step in the right direction and will probably benefit wildlife. However, the amount of flexibility in your plan is so great that it is difficult for me to visualize the end product. He continues, I think that such uncertainty is to some extent inevitable, but I'm sure it will make very many people nervous about your plan since there will be suspicion that the plan is really just business as usual, dressed up to look good. So that's what a few scientists had to say about their plan. And I'm about to wrap it up here, so I'm sure there's concern about time. As you're all aware that there are groups that want to significantly increase logging in the Tillamook Rainforest, SB 699 would turn this unique Oregon jewel into a 40-year rotation tree farm. There are groups that want to turn the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest into a park that would allow no logging at all. These are the bookends. The Tillamook Rainforest Coalition has brought forward the compromise. We believe that 50% of these state lands should be managed for the first purpose of clean water, fish, wildlife, and recreation. By doing this, ODF will fully comply with the greatest permanent value statute and will achieve that goal for all Oregonians. Senate Bill 430 would implement our goals of achieving economic and environmental balance in the Tillamook Rainforest and will prevent the inevitable lawsuits that will arise as ODF continues to place timber production as the priority over amenities that we as Oregonians need to maintain our number one attraction. And the number one attraction in Oregon is our quality of life. Furthermore, the key to economic health is a diverse economy. As currently implemented, the state's plan puts all of its eggs in one basket, the resource extraction basket. We do not think that this is the wisest choice for the people of Oregon, nor do we believe this is what the citizens of Oregon want or deserve. We think our plan will achieve balance for the economic and environmental health of Oregon. Now, if I have time, I'd like to show a 3.5-minute video, but if you want to cut me off,
no,
that's fine.
I can't permit that at this point.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I answer Senator Corcoran's question, which was a restatement of Senator Beyer's question about...
Very briefly.
I would just like to say the fear of environmental groups blocking forest health, thinnings, timber sales, etc., regarding the kind of activities we would allow is unfounded, and all you have to do is call Forest Supervisor Gloria Brown at the Sayous Law and ask what the relationship is with the environmental community for plantation thinning and numerous timber harvests that go on there regarding the kinds of issues we're talking about. There is no problem, there is no controversy, and there is a complete agreement.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, can I ask one question?
Yes,
I guess the same question I asked the person from Travel Limited was, why is it that you believe that timber harvest and recreation are two mutually exclusive concepts?
Let me take a shot at that. That's the question. And the question is, what is the alternative economic potential of a robust amenity recreation strategy for portions of the landscape? The intensive multiple entry thinning regime structure-based management requires precludes most amenity uses that software developers in Washington County might want to go do in the area that they would go to the National Forest on the east side for. You can't have a the disturbance and presence of this intensive harvest regime does not allow for the kinds of recreations people have come to expect from these kinds of landscapes. And so people use the term lock up. What in fact an intensive regime like this is a lockout of an alternative economic potential and the kinds of revenues we get from what that economy will give us. And the amenities of quiet hiking, quiet recreation, unimpeded views, these are all going to be excluded under a very intensive multiple thinning regime requiring an intensive amount of activity every year on every acre. So it's not that you can't go and have a picnic, but if you're a software developer or someone thinking about taking a software developer job and you say, oh, where can I go have a nice hike, not being bothered and all that, they're going to say, well, you have to drive 100 miles east. It's too bad you can't drive 20 miles west, but they're so busy over there logging and thinning and doing everything, there's this whole range of amenities that will be precluded, not to mention clean water, drinking water, and those kinds of factors.
Thank you.
I'd like to be able to give it a specific example of that with the round belly timber sale that's going to build miles of road directly over the Gales Creek Trail. It's one of the only trails out in Forest Grove that's so close. We're going out there April 6th to look at it. We're inviting the Oregon Department of Forestry, they've agreed to come, County Commissioner Dick Scouten, and we're going to ask the question, why are you building miles of road over an active hiking trail? It just simply doesn't make sense. That trail is going to have to be shut down while those logging operations are going on, and because of clean water issues, they're only going to be able to do that during the times when most people hike. So this is a very clear example. We're going out on April 6th, Senator Beyer, Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, I welcome all of you to come on this hike with us. The small woodlot owners are going to be out there with us, and so it's going to be an eclectic group of people talking about what is the best use of this forest.
Have you got a security team going along with this eclectic group?
The only thing I am telling everybody is that it's 6 miles uphill, and so that's the
limit participation.
Excuse me. Yeah, it will limit. We'll have a little gathering at the Gales Creek campground before for those people who aren't interested
Senator
in
Beyer
running up.
Ask a question.
Okay,
I can tell.
It's more of a rebuttal, I guess. I wish someone would inform all of my neighbors on all my timberland that recreation is not allowed or not a good experience in managed forests, because I own managed forests all over Clackamas County. And if our neighbors would agree to that, we would not have so much problem with people going through our property and going through managed forests from clear cuts to 70-year-old timber that are actively managed.
I appreciate very much. I'm sorry I'm feeling the pressure of time this morning. As you're heading back to your seats, I'm inviting Rex Storm up. He's against. I'm trying to keep this for and against routine going here. And I need to say, while we're in process here, that in a few minutes I'm going to slip out of the room for a second. I have to do testimony in another room. I'll be right back. Senator Beyer will chair in my absence, and it is my intention Everybody else may leave, but I'll stay here until everybody's done. So let's just pick it up and see how well we can get through, okay? Thank you for coming this morning, Rex. Appreciate having you.
Good morning, Chairman Shields, committee members. My name is Rex Storm. I am Forest Policy Manager for Associated Oregon Loggers located here in Salem. I'm also a certified forester, recognized by the Society of American Foresters, which ascribes me to standards of professional conduct. I appreciate this opportunity to speak before you this morning in opposition of Senate Bills 430 and 699. I'm here on behalf of more than 1,000 member companies of the association known as AOL. Our trade association represents a majority of the timber harvest professionals in Oregon, or some 10,000 Oregonians employed mostly in rural areas. Much of the forest management conducted on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest is operated by contract loggers and allied member companies of AOL on a contract basis. We strongly oppose and cannot accept the concept of codifying prescriptive forest management by statute, as proposed in these two bills. Forest allocation and scheduling decisions, which are necessary to accomplish the greatest permanent value of the state lands, must be diagnosed and prescribed by land management professionals. Effective forestry decisions are not best made by interest group lobbyists or legislators. Land management professionals in the state agencies should have the authority and not be shackled by one-size-fits-all edicts, which these two bills would awkwardly propose. These two bills reach far beyond reasonable policymaking in their attempt to dictate specific forest prescriptions for state forest lands. AOL cannot accept either bill for this reason, but let me add that there are other contradictions that we disdain. I will outline or list six more reasons why we oppose these bills. First, these bills would destroy the balance created by the purpose of the lands rule and the state forest plan. You have already heard testimony from others about the plan's balance to derive the greatest permanent value and how the proposed bills that you are considering would demolish this existing balance of uses. Second, harvest and habitat can be increased under current rule and plan. Third, unintended consequences of these bills would be costly and yield fewer benefits in terms of habitat and timber. Fourth, vague and contradictory language in these bills would pose legal problems that would further lead to distrust in litigation surrounding state forests. Fifth, ample habitat provisions are being protected under current plan and rule. State forest rules and plans acknowledge that habitat in the landscape context comes from the unique contributions of all forest ownership classes. And that would include federal, industrial, family, tribal, local, urban, agricultural, and state forests. And lastly, no persuasive need for either of these two proposed laws, these two proposed bills, exist. Existing administrative rules and plans afford ample opportunity for adaptive management and future improvement, if you will. Why then would we pass new laws to further confound a forest strategy that is working now to improve both timber and habitat? In closing, we urge you to vote in opposition of both Senate Bill 430 and 699. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Questions? Do you have a copy of your testimony you could...
Yes, I gave a copy to
okay.
this guy.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Carolyn, is it Edie? And same time when Brad Witt come up. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Carolyn Edie. I live in Jewell, which is in the center of logging activity in Clatsop County. I've served on the Jewell School Board. I've been a member of the Clatsop Implementation Group. I've worn out my copy of the forest management plan. It literally is falling apart. I recognize the importance of logging to our community, to our school and the district. I would not like to see the forest completely closed to logging. On the other hand, I would second some of the earlier testimony. Living there, this is really a unique habitat, and we do get 100 inches of rain in Jewell. It's one of the most productive areas in the world. The perspective I'd like to offer is I'm going to initially focus on Clatsop. I have about 145 or 50,000 acres. The bulk of it is managed by the Astoria District. About 51% or 70,000 acres of that total land base are not currently available for commercial operations, and I do list here the various reasons. We have several northern spotted owl cluster areas. You have to remove the areas for roads and streams and riparian areas. And then there are other operational issues that make that part of the land not available for commercial operation. I think these are valid. They reflect environmental laws. They reflect values of the people of Oregon. The implementation plan for this area, their goal is to clear cut approximately 1.1% of the acres each year. Now, they state it as 0.6, but they only apply that to 125,000 of the 136,000 acres. I think they've removed the roads and streams. So the effective clear cut rate is 1.1%. I state here, and we have heard again today, this tremendous pressure from County Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee to increase this rate of timber production. I have seen in this 04 draft there's going to be a 10% increase in clear cutting where I live in Astoria District. The chart on the second page this chart on the second page shows the impact of these various scenarios. There's a bar chart here that shows that what the average rate has been, what the 50% plan is, it's page 2 of your handout, what the midpoint range is, what they're targeting. The pressure is now to operate at the top of that range, but then there's another step above that, which is the county's trust lands optimum yield. I should note that chart applies to all of the Clatsop Tillamook area. When you analyze this, what it states is about the rotation age. I think one of the previous speakers mentioned that. The stated goal of 0.6 would give you a 167-year rotation. The actual goal of 1.1 is 91. It's moving down. The operating plan coming up for the next year is 83. The top of the goal range, which they have been pressed to operate in for the next 3 years until, or 2 years until they can revise this simulation model, would take it down to 59, and it maybe typical industrial rotation would be 45 years or 2.2% cut per year. My conclusion is, I think the Clatsop State Forest is being managed. There are legitimate constraints that prevent commercial operations in 50%. I did a quick check at Tillamook. Their numbers are similar because they have a lot of acres that are non-commercial due to Swiss needle cast. Excuse me. Unless the laws for the Endangered Species Act change, or they do go to a habitat conservation plan, you know, I put that the 50% requirement in this Senate bill is not that significant, but hearing the testimony this morning, I think If that is under attack of what is currently being used for legitimate set-asides, then maybe it is required. The real question to me is how that other 50% of the forest will be managed. It's clear to me that the county group is pressuring for a commercial level of logging on that remaining acreage. I don't believe that's appropriate. And I'd like to state why. I think the forest management plan calls for managing 100% of the forest to achieve the greatest permanent value, which you probably know it, the social, economic, and environmental benefits. I think you can't achieve that when you are in that intensive of a logging operation and that other 50% that's not managing for the GPV. They have a plan laid out for 50% of that forest to grow. Take it 50, 60 years. It's going to be older. It's going to be layered and OFS. It's beyond me to conceive how that can be achieved where the other half is being so intensely harvested. And the final reason, probably most important, I don't think it'll be sustainable. You're going to get into the boom and bust periods, and I think there'll be a backlash by the public. I don't want to see the forest shut down. I think it would be devastating to some of these rural counties and communities. But to see, I have felt personally the increase in harvesting the last 3 years where I live. I had to go past 6 trucks to get out today. And that's been a real step up the last 3 years. I look at that chart and say, my God, it's going to be, they were like twice that. It will be so apparent. I see ballot initiatives or something, and I don't want to see that. So I guess I would conclude that the plan has either a, I guess you would say it has a floor for revenue. Another approach might be a ceiling for timber harvesting. But whatever, I think there are, I'm supportive of the forest management plan. I would prefer to see the department and the Board of Forestry see the wisdom of a moderate position and not go to the extreme where there would be a public backlash. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming. It's good to hear from citizens on the issue. Brad?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I have also been a member of our state's Board of Forestry since 1996. I hasten to point out that I'm neither representing the board nor the department here today. I only offer that as experience in my gaining a perspective on what constitutes a sustainable forestry and the greatest permanent value. I also happen to live very close to the Clatsop State Forest and use that from time to time for recreational purposes. Mr. Chairman, when you opened the hearing on Monday, you characterized these bills as two bookends, and I think that that was a most apropos metaphor. Unfortunately, the polar opposites that these bookends represent are painful reminders of the decades-long conflict between protective and consumptive values for our forest resources. That conflict, however, is an anachronism and is something that we no longer have time for. In the interests of brevity, I will attempt to summarize my statement. There is too much at stake for deadlock, threatened and endangered species, forest products jobs, school and road budgets, timber producer profits, quality of life for human and natural communities, and the respect that we as Oregonians have for each other and the environment. These are all at stake. Oregon is blessed by having one of the finest forestry departments, not only in our country, but in the entire world. And the Northwest Forest Management Plan, which includes the Clatsop and Potomac State Forests, is a first-rate product of that department. The plan was 7 years in the making. It underwent rigorous scientific analysis and review, as well as what sometimes felt, I think I can speak for the, my other board members in this instance, interminable public input. The plan also constitutes a system of continuous improvement based as it is on adaptive management. At this point, I will refer back to my prepared statements. If you want to follow along, I'm about two-thirds of the way down on page two at this point. The development of the forest management plan was guided by the greatest permanent value and the principles of sustainable forestry. The FMP balances the protection of flora, fauna, air, water, and soil with a projected annual timber harvest of 279 million board feet. The plan fosters a diversity of habitats to meet the needs of all native species while providing for significant human recreational needs. Unique to the Northwest Forest Management Plan is structure-based management. This is an active management regime which will achieve complex forest structures in approximately 4.5 decades. Structure-based management will hasten this desired future condition by managing for timber stand characteristics, such as stand conditions and structures, rather than age exclusively. The Northwest Forest Management Plan also implements aquatic and riparian strategies intended to maintain and restore watershed health, assure the purity of water, and promote properly functioning aquatic habitats. Similarly, the plan provides anchor habitats for the recovery of salmonids and other imperiled species. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Oregon AFL-CIO urges you to leave Senate Bills 430 and 699 just where they are in your committee. We also urge your enthusiastic support for the Northwest Forest Management Plan and for the men and women of the Oregon Department of Forestry, whose dedication and professionalism will continue to bring the state the greatest permanent value for many decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate your characterization of the idea that, you know, we're at a point where we can't afford what looks like it's coming, you know?
That's right.
Increased polarization. It just occurs to me that everybody's in a high-stakes poker game here.
It is.
And what I see is the potential of, in a state that's going broke, we'll waste $10 or $15 million in some ballot measure fight, and nobody wins in that context.
That is precisely the case, Mr. Chairman. And when any one of the values, economic, social, environmental, is elevated above the interests of the others, the result is gridlock, and it is the mutual destruction of all of these values, and we no longer have time for that.
As a member of the board, I'm sure you've been contemplating this. Is there? I know that you've been at it for years, 6, 7, 8, whatever, in the development of the plan. I know the plan makes nobody happy. The counties aren't happy with it. Certainly the environmental community's not happy with it. OFIC's not happy with it. And I'm just the Johnny-come-lately on this issue, although after 5.5 hours of hearing, I feel like I'm getting better acquainted, and I got 3 months of homework, thanks to everybody's testimony, I think. But is there any way you can see compromise from this kind of polarization that you've witnessed over the years?
Mr. Chairman, the best example of, I wouldn't say necessarily compromise, but balance. Balance is exemplified by the Northwest Forest Management Plan. It manages for all values simultaneously, elevates none at the expense of others, and achieves those characteristics I think that all of us want from our forests. Protection of the resources, generation of commodity products, availability of recreational pursuit, recovery of endangered species. All of these are managed for across the landscape and over time. It is a paragon of public policy in the making. The department and more importantly the foresters and the personnel over there are to be commended for the job that they have done here.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Carolyn and Brad, both, I thank you for coming very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to ask David Williams if he'd come and picking up the pace, because they just brought me another sheet of people that want to testify. David Williams and I can't make out your writing. Is it Cameron La Follette? Please both come if you're still here. Maybe people are leaving, I don't know, in droves probably. Is David Williams not in the room? Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Cameron La Follette. I'm a member of and am today representing the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, which is a member of the Tillamook Rainforest Coalition. I wanted to give you a little background about Oregon Shores and why we have an interest in this matter. Oregon Shores is a statewide organization founded in 1971 of more than 1,000 members interested in coastal protection. We also have hundreds of volunteers who participate in a mile-by-mile beach monitoring program. We also have local affiliates that help in organizing in individual areas, and our affiliate in Tillamook County is a strong and active one. Oregon Shores' mission statement describes our territory as covering the area from the crest of the Coast Range in to the Pacific Ocean and to the three-mile limit beyond that, which covers the Tillamook Rainforest area. We've followed this issue about what should be the ultimate management strategy for the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest for many years. Oregon Shores, being a member of the Tillamook Rainforest Coalition, supports its positions. And one of the main reasons for this is Tillamook Bay. Oregon Shores has worked on the water quality issues of Tillamook Bay for many years. Partly due to the sediment load that is in Tillamook Bay, there's been a lot of concern and interest to dredge in the bay. Tillamook Bay is listed by the state as a conservation estuary, which prescribes limits on dredging. But there has been a lot of interest in dredging in the bay because of the amount of sediment in. Many of our members are involved in the Tillamook Bay National Estuary Program, which is federally supported. And that plan, which is ongoing and being worked on, seeks to plan for and conserve the bay's water quality and natural resources. Tillamook Bay's water quality is directly impacted by actions taken in the Tillamook Rainforest, which is home to the Miami, Trask, Tillamook, Wilson, and Kilchis Rivers, all of which flow into Tillamook Bay. Many of our members and other coastal residents rely on the Nehalem and other rivers for drinking water, and its quality is of critical concern to these downstream coastal residents. There was previous testimony about drinking water matters primarily related to Washington County. We have been focusing more on drinking water matters related to the coastal communities. Bay City, Garibaldi, and the town of Tillamook get all or part of their drinking water from surface or groundwater sources that depend on the Tillamook Rainforest. All are subject to contamination due to excessive logging, as well as sedimentation. Senate Bill 430 would create a true balance in the rainforest between the essential protections necessary for clean water, salmon, and biodiversity, while also caring for the important economic health of local communities. The Oregon Department of Forestry is not mandated to manage state forests solely for timber production, and we believe that Senate Bill 430 does this very admirably, and we support the bill and hope that you will send it out of committee to the Senate floor when you've finished hearing all the testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
I did appreciate give a copy of the testimony to the
good
administrator.
I appreciate that. More homework, but I'll read it. I asked for David Williams a minute ago. I asked for him to come forward if he's still here. Jeff Merrick is next on the list. Oh, David did submit his testimony before he left. My apologies. Is Jeff Merrick still here? There.
Thanks.
Jeff, thank you for coming. And I'm also going to ask for Daniel Hall. Is that right? At this point, I want to state that I've been trying to do pro and con. We've run out of folks on the opposing side, so please summarize your testimony, because we are running out of time and I've still got six people. So if you give me summaries of your testimony, and please give us written testimony. Everybody remaining is testifying in favor of Senate Bill 430, so unless we want to get the same person coming back every 2 minutes, well, I'm not going to be able to do the balancing act. And also, Senator Beyer and I have both said that we would like to try and get the Forest Service folks back. We may have to call them the Department of... Yeah, I keep screwing that up. My apologies to all you guys. If we can't get you back today, we certainly want to have you come back and answer some of the questions that have come to our mind. Please, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Senate Bill 430 is a good bill, and it retains the timber production levels for the old economies. And the old economies are those few companies that actually go out there and bid and log, the Hampton Tree Farms, the Seneca Sawmills, the Stimson Logging Companies. But more important, SB 30 preserves the new economies, the Intels and the Nikes, which is the engine for the robust Washington County and state economies. Oregon's reputation for environmental protection is important to draw these new knowledge-based companies and their workers to Oregon. Oregon is an inspiration to people. People come here because of the feel of Oregon. And you want to quibble about board feet and things, this SB 30, 430, protects the old economies. It gives them the same number of logs or more than they're having now. It's going to keep the economy chugging along, but it's not cutting off the new economies that need this kind of attraction so that people come here and not to Atlanta or to the Silicon Valley. The economic analyses, I'm convinced, are flawed because they don't place a value on the benefits of keeping the trees and the forests in pristine condition or improving them to pristine condition. Today's Oregonian, one of the forest industry said, what is the cost-benefit analysis of keeping the stream sides pristine? Well, maybe that should be the law. Go get that analysis, because the city of Portland is looking at $200 million for a water plant filtration. This is big dollars. The forest industry says, well, why do you want to keep logs on the ground? Well, ask the people of Tillamook, who keep getting flooded these days because of that. The 50% of the forest that's to be managed for conservation purposes, Senator Beyer, I am in litigation. I've been a litigator in Oregon for 19 years, and I can tell you, you don't start litigation unless you feel like it's going to be there's a good reason for it. If the forest department is genuinely managing that forest for the purposes that you set forth in this bill, people are not going to waste their time and energy on litigation. And that is your job, is to set a vision. And I respect the work you do, and I thank you for the sacrifices you make to serve on this committee. And I know you guys make a lot of sacrifices to work on this. And by doing that, I know you join a long line of people who have sacrificed to serve an Oregon vision. And when we think about those people, the Oregon giants of our day, we think about a Bob Straub who made the beach a public domain. And you think about Tom McCall, who protected the environment. And I ask you to look in your hearts and to say, what will be my legacy? Am I going to stand for a Tillamook State Forest, or do I just want a Tillamook tree farm? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you, Senator Beyer. I'm Daniel Hall with the American Lands Alliance. American Lands works with thousands of conservation organs and citizens in Oregon and nationwide to protect and recover our wildlife and wild places. We urge you to support Senate Bill 430. The Tillamook and Clatsop are the only significant public forests in the northwest region of the state, and they need to be managed for public values that are not found on the majority of surrounding industrial timberlands. Senate Bill 430 would restore balance to the management of the Tillamook and Clatsop. The bill would make non-timber forest management a priority on half the forest, while allowing the other half to be managed principally for commercial timber objectives. Senate Bill 430 would expressly maintain historical levels of timber harvest and local timber-related revenues, while promoting local economic diversification by improving fish and wildlife habitat, recreational opportunities, water quality, and opportunity for businesses that depend upon those resources, much as you just heard. In fact, Senate Bill 430 would increase timber harvest levels by 26% over the last decade. The Department of Forestry's proposed management direction for these forests would not adequately sustain populations of imperiled fish, wildlife, and plants. The Department's management direction is certainly better than the approach taken by many timber companies in the region. However, the Department's proposed structure-based management is still not sufficient for fish, wildlife, and plant species that need genuine older forest habitat conditions that are sensitive to intensive logging or that need stable habitats that don't move around frequently. As a result, as you heard earlier, the majority of an independent scientific review conducted by Oregon State University found that the state's plan would likely lead to significant harm to many of these imperiled species. Everyone talks about wanting sustainable forestry. It's time we actually start sustaining our forest ecosystems and public trust resources. The management direction envisioned in Senate Bill 430 will do a better job of protecting, sustaining, and restoring water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, and other public values. It will maintain and even increase historical levels of timber harvests and local timber-based revenues. And it will improve economic opportunities associated with fish, wildlife, clean water, recreation, and other forest resources. With that, I'd just like to wrap up by responding to a point that was raised earlier regarding rotation length and net present values. One of the things I think the Department of Forestry is doing right is using longer timber rotations on the Tillamook Clats, but also the Elliott State Forest. Longer timber rotations can produce greater amounts of timber per acre per year than shorter rotations that are driven by net present value calculations. Now, there's some very good reasons why private companies use net present value calculations, but you need to understand that they discount the value of future timber harvests and shortchange the productive capacity of forests from a volume perspective. I don't think that's the type of model we should be using on our state public forests. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions? I know we're rushing, and my apologies to you, but I do appreciate both of you coming this morning.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Jeff and Pam Birmingham if they're here, if they'll come forward. Are they here? And while they're coming forward, I want to thank County Commissioner Josie for coming back for some continuing education this morning. We do all we can for our county commissioners. Are there any other county commissioners in the room that... Some of the continuing education has been a bit painful, and County Commissioner Hanneman got early release because he's an advanced student. County Commissioner Josie, of course, is still here. Would you go ahead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeffrey Birmingham, I will cut my address short to approximately 3 minutes.
Thank you very much.
I wish to speak on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, specifically from the vantage of the Sierra Club's Tillamook Clats of State Forest Committee, of which I am chair. But in doing so, please understand that I only wish to provide some context to the currently polarized debate which swirls around Senate Bill 430 and the confusion generated by Senate Bill 699. Firstly, someone from Monday's audience referred to Senate Bill 430 and Senate Bill 699 as bookends to the overall state forest discussion. I wish to respectfully disagree with that reference because it infers that the theoretical middle ground between these two Senate bills constitutes a balance between consumptive and non-consumptive uses of the state forest. Consider instead that if you had X acres of forest and you intended to log every acre, you could, then that is what we currently actually have as the purported middle ground, and that is not regarded as a bookend. Or consider that you had X acres of forest and decided to split those acres into half for consumptive purposes and half into non-consumptive purposes, that would truly be the middle ground within the larger discussion. Number two, therefore, I respectfully submit that the first real issue of consideration is how to define the concept of balanced use of our public forests. At Monday's session, I heard much praise for ODF Forest Management Plan, FMP, and I must admit to being an ardent supporter of the FMP myself. The aspect of this document that is most visionary is the greatest permanent value component, GPV, because it recognizes and values non-consumptive forest uses. But those of us who have for years studied the alleged implementation of the FMP have learned that the FMP balanced vision is not actually practiced in the forest. Number three. To ascertain balance between consumptive and non-consumptive state forest uses, one can employ an objective perspective gained from a time continuum. At one end of the continuum were native forests in a variety of natural successional stages. The other end of the continuum is where we are today, with management plans for monocultural tree plantations upon every acre. The two operative words used herein are forests and plantations. We in the Sierra Club see a great difference between these two terms, yet ODF uses them interchangeably. So we suggest that a balanced use of the forest would be comprised of some managed tree plantations and some managed non-managed native forests with some management allowances. some intensively managed, some not. Number four, ODF silvicultural management is an adaptive process which seeks to construct man-made crop plantations through a learn-as-you-go method called structure-based management, SBM. Structure-based management has never been proven or tried anywhere at any time on this planet. Yet all our state forests are now committed to this gamble. The Sierra Club suggests that ODF should balance their inductive form of farming with the deductive creation of forest reserves, which will retain remnants of original native forest types and their native genetic seed stocks. This action would guarantee recovery from any future failed forest technologies. Any reasonable person would suggest that if you're going to manipulate something, don't throw away all the parts. Number five, forest reserves would also provide for the most critical element of forest health, biodiversity. Biodiversity is the key to multispecial preservation because providing naturally existing habitats is known to be the key for animal and plant survival. Under structure-based management, ODF intends to type convert the extreme majority of forest lands into farms of even-age monocultures, which may become reasonably good tree farms but also become biological deserts. Please do not be misled into believing that structure-based management's older forest structure component has anything to do with old growth or biodiversity. It does not. To ignore the fact that full-spectrum biodiversity is quite achievable and to instead practice exclusively a commodity-based forestry is simply not good stewardship, as ODF claims. And number six, I have heard the word sustainability used as a rationale for logging all the available acres of our state forest, for claiming that logging is more important than any other forest value, and for defining the value of our public forests in exclusively commodity terms. I submit to you that sustainability in these terms is the bookend definition, because this interpretation of sustainability does not reflect the middle ground of forest sustainability. There are other values held by people in this state regarding their public forests, and these values, too, have merit. Some of the intangible and intangible forest values are actually quite ancient and elemental. So why should sustainability only refer to the forest's commodity values? Shouldn't the just concept of sustainability encompass both consumptive and non-consumptive values, wherein both value systems are sustained? In summation, and in cutting my remarks short, you as a committee are now to weigh the same basic question, and you as the leaders who are vested with protecting the long-term interests of the state. Will you proceed from the vantage of logic and prudence or from the sole vantage of short-term economics? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate your coming and sharing. I just wanted to finish my comment. I have always regretted it when I've had a throwaway comment, which is what the bookends comment was intended to be. It certainly has helped us have a conversation, but both supporters of Senate Bill 699 and Senate Bill 430 have beat me up because neither one of them sees them as ends. They're, you know, the ends are somewhere. I guess it's whether it's the front of the end zone or the back of the end zone that I was referring to. I'm not sure. Senator Beyer, you have a comment or a question?
I just said, I apologize that you have to leave, but I would like to present to you from the committee a birthday card. And
thank you very much.
But, you know, appreciate, you know, the work you've done on this committee, and you've been very fair and trying to recognize what both sides want to do, and I appreciate it as a committee member. And I'm not going to ask how old you are, but Judith does tell me that there is some party, donuts, someplace after the committee.
After we adjourn, it'll have to be on the Senate floor. Give me a break.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
He is old enough to join ARP, though.
Hey, I've been a member of ARP for about 10 years now. No, eight. Let's be clear about this. Pam, I'm sorry to keep you sitting there. I knew that Senator Beyer had a meeting at 10:30 that he has to race to. So would you go ahead, please?
Thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you for your willingness to listen with open minds to this debate about these two bills. I live in the Coast Range of Clatsop County. For the past 13 years, I've worked as a real estate agent, and I'm very familiar with the economic workings of Clatsop County. I have a degree in forestry, and I also work part-time as a park ranger for the National Park Service at Fort Clatsop. For the past 4 years, I've attended almost every Board of Forestry meeting.
Pam, did you put your name on the record? Maybe she did, but okay.
Oh, Pam Birmingham.
Okay, Pam, an amazing combination of real estate and part-time forestry. That's great. Keep going.
Thanks. And to balance that and to be knowledgeable, I have gone to almost every Board of Forestry meeting, including sitting through all the John Sessions modelings for the Forest Management Plan. I spend a lot of time out in the woods. We do ground truthing. We go hiking. I have some on-the-ground experience in the forests of Clatsop County. Just some basic facts, because I know you're being overwhelmed with information. The current management plan by the Department of Forestry calls for every acre, except for minimal or riparian setbacks, to be logged over time. Not one acre is slated to become old growth. They will grow it to a longer rotation, but then it will be cut. Point number two, there are no federal lands in Clatsop County. The significance of that is, based on what I said in point one, there is nowhere that's going to become old growth in Clatsop County. There is not one area slated to actually show what this rainforest looked like. And I'd like to be able to show my grandchildren what it used to look like here. Earlier, Senator George spoke about how back in the 1940s, ODF pioneered new technology in reforesting the Tillamook Burn. And now he says the forest is in trouble because they didn't know about the importance of using local seed sources. And I think that's interesting because structure-based management is an unproven experiment, or a grand experiment, as Dean Salwasser from Oregon State University said to you in his presentation on Monday. The gentleman from Hampton Tree Farm said we need to look at these lands from a business perspective. Now, would the prudent businessman risk 100% of their assets on an unproven experiment? That's what structure-based management is. That's why Senate Bill 430 makes sense. It allows the harvesting of Swiss needle cast disease stands, and it retains some of the native forests in case structure-based management doesn't work. Well, it still produces a sustainable level of revenues for the counties. I was going to mention the significance of the Crabtree case about producing revenue, but I think that's been mentioned plenty. The DEQ has recently completed their study of stream conditions in the North Coast Basin. The Nehalem River is consistently dangerously warm for salmon. A lot of that has to do with removal of vegetation on the tributaries. We now protect the main stem fairly well. We've got some setbacks, so it's shaded. But there's what keeps that cool, if you look through the DEQ report, as all these small tributaries enter the main stem, they cool that water and they keep it just below or right at lethal levels for salmonids. Now, if those aren't protected, those temperatures are going to continue to rise and we're going to lose even more of our fisheries. This is a point that I've experienced very recently. As a realtor, I've recently lost several good qualified buyers who were in the $300,000 range for a home who wanted to relocate to the North Coast range. But after showing them property after property, everywhere we went, there was either sediment-choked rivers or clear cuts or thinnings that were so heavy they appeared to be clear cuts, and all of those buyers chose to go elsewhere. That's had a negative impact on our economy. As a park ranger at Fort Clatsop, I'm constantly asked by visitors from all over the world, where can we go to see these forests as they used to be? And I have to say, not here in Clatsop County. And there's no chance for it to happen there. The economic health of Clatsop County is no longer tied to timber production. But I see the future of Clatsop County as protecting our natural resources and the quality of life so that buyers like this with good-sized incomes can move there and contribute to the local economy. I'm going to beat your book into death one more time. I don't see it as bookend either. I see it as the first step toward balancing the desires of all Oregonians. This bill is the way to end polarization and reach a compromise and keep the Department of Forestry out of court and out in the forest where we'd all like them to be. Please don't, well, Yeah, please don't allow them to steal from our heritage. As I said earlier, I'd love my grandchildren to see some old growth and see what the forest used to look like. Thank you for your time.
Pam, thank you for very fine testimony. David Gabrielson?
Gabriel.
Come on up. My apologies, but I have been not requested, but more or less ordered to the Senate President's office in 5 minutes. And so
okay.
I'm going to have to hurry if you could give us a couple minutes. I also want to say that I hope the Department of Forestry has been listening, because we sure have written down lots of questions for you, and I'm sure you've picked them up today. We'll be talking with you later and hope the debate goes on. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Shields and committee, for allowing me to speak today. I am a professional forester. If the Board of Forestry were managing our state forests, as they would lead you to believe, I would not be here. I have spent over 30 years witnessing the ongoing deterioration of the temperate rainforest ecosystem that once covered much of Western Oregon. When I graduated from college with my degree in forest management, I had been taught that the original forests were overaged, decaying, and needing to be harvested. These forests would be replaced with vigorous super tree seedlings that would be harvested in 60 years. These super trees would produce the same kind of volume that the original forests did. I was also taught that this was sustainable forest management. My first job out of college was located in Southwest Oregon. In a very short period of time, I realized that the original forests were being harvested too rapidly to allow the planted trees to reach 60 years before they would need to be harvested. In addition, these planted trees would in fact yield only a fraction of the original forest volumes. Most important, I came to realize that this type of management is not healthy for the environment, nor is it truly sustainable. Currently, the timber industry clear-cut harvests most of their lands at a rotation age of 50 years or less. The next clear-cut harvest will likely consist of trees only 40 years old. Under this scenario, each successive harvest produces less volume than the previous. In comparison to the total acres repeatedly clear-cut harvested, very few acres are commercially thinned or selectively logged. I believe that successive clear-cutting of forest crops, as the timber industry refers to their trees, significantly contributes to the reduction of soil productivity. Any farmer who understands the value of the soil knows if you do not put back into the soil what you take out, the productivity deteriorates. The timber industry's management practices do very little to replenish the productivity of forest soils. It is my personal and professional opinion that our state forests are being managed in the manner I have just described. I do not want our state forests managed in this unhealthy and unsustainable way. I want to see our forests managed with the primary goal being to maintain the health and the integrity of the temperate rainforest ecosystem. This will produce intrinsic value that is far greater than any monetary value by increasing the quantity and the quality of clean water, maintaining soil productivity, and improving the health and livability of the environment. We owe this to future generations of Oregonians. The second goal should be to produce a reasonable income flow that is truly sustainable. This will help to put an end to the historic boom and bust economic cycles that the timber industry's management practices continue to cause. It is my opinion that the timber industry views standing trees as having very little value. Their true worth is attained only after they have been harvested and converted to a saleable commodity. This is why I believe Senate Bill 430 should be passed. Manage 50% of the Tillamook forest to demonstrate how a forest can be managed to improve and sustain both the health of the environment and the health of the economy. Senate Bill 430 does not lock up or squander this forest ecosystem resource. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it very much. Thank you for all the homework. We'll be talking about this in one venue or another, I think, in days ahead. Senator Fisher.
Before you whine the gavel, that great paragon of wisdom, Senator Wyden, said several years ago that what we need to do is cut more newer trees. And that's been widely, he's been widely hailed by the environmental community. Now it looks to me like as we approach that type of thing, all of a sudden it isn't what is wanted either. So we have had some interesting comments and some interesting testimony in the last couple of committee meetings.
Yes, we have. Thank you all, and stay tuned. With that, the committee's adjourned.